This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. George Zimmerman was pronounced not guilty of second-degree murder for the killing of Trayvon Martin. He was acquitted on the grounds of self-defense. So what does self-defense mean in a case like this? And before the trial began, Judge Deborah Nelson forbade the use of the term racial profiling in the courtroom. Was race a factor? How does race play into the criminal justice system? And what does this case, tried in Florida, mean for us in North Carolina? Mark Anthony Neal is a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University. Irving Joyner is a professor of law at North Carolina Central, and he also serves as legal counsel for the North Carolina NAACP. Nia Wilson is executive director of Spirit House here in Durham, and Alexis Pauline Gums is a black feminist scholar and poet. She's on the program today, and we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. We're talking about the George Zimmerman verdict and also the implications for the state of North Carolina and racial profiling and all of the elements that played a part in that case. 877-962-9862 is the number to call. Let me start with you, Irving Joyner, and talk about this case, the verdict in this case, the law that was at the heart of it, and sort of how this verdict played out.
Well, the George Zimmerman was charged here with second-degree murder, which means essentially that the killing that was involved here involved malice, that there was a killing with malice, which carries with it the requirement that the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt each element of that offense. And there's no doubt that there was a killing which occurred, and then the issue became whether it was with malice. In every jurisdiction, there's this notion of self-defense. One of the hallmarks of self-defense is that it applies to the innocent victim of crime. In Florida, there's a kind of a derivation on that, and they created this notion of the castle rule for out in public squares. Castle rule typically applies to in your home, where you don't have to first retreat to avoid the necessity of killing someone. And this doctrine was extended in Florida, where you have your stand your ground. And there was a claim that George Zimmerman stood his ground. The problem with that that defense is that you have to also establish that he was an innocent victim, that he in no way caused the confrontation that resulted. But after a presentation of what I think was a very shoddy show of evidence, the jury returned a verdict of not guilty, and apparently did a pretty thorough job of examining the evidence and even the lesser charge of manslaughter, which they asked the judge to give additional instructions on, and they found George Zimmerman not guilty based on the failure of the state to be able to establish his case.
Well, tell us more about that, about what you think the state should have done and the strength of the state's case.
Well, you know, in the trial world, one of the things that you learn when putting on a trial is that you start out with your strongest witness and you end up your case with your second strongest witness. In this case, the state apparently put on its weakest witness, although that should have been the strongest witness, and apparently the young lady who was talking with Trayvon Martin at the time of this incident was either a reluctant witness and certainly was a ill-prepared witness who was not able to handle the vigorous cross-examination from the defendant. And so she came off looking very bad, quite inarticulate in the presentation. There was a lot of conflicts in her testimony. Then the second witness that the state had was the investigator, who was the first on the scene and the person to gather evidence together that would make up the body of any prosecution. And his weakness was revealed when he proclaimed that he believed George Zimmerman and the story that he had presented. So now you have your strongest two witnesses basically adding fuel to the defendant's claim, and it's pretty difficult for the state to overcome those deficiencies in the presentation of the testimony. So my thinking was and is now that the jury had a difficult time trying to impose their own view in light of the state's failure to present any really strong evidence to support his claim of second-degree murder, and then in the final analysis of manslaughter.
On the State of Things today, we are talking about the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case, aftermath of the verdict of not guilty. George Zimmerman found not guilty of second-degree murder and manslaughter. And my guests today are Mark Anthony Neal, a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke. Irving Joyner is a professor of law at North Carolina Central, also serves as legal counsel for the North Carolina NAACP. Nia Wilson is with us, executive director of Spirit House, and Alexis Pauline Gums, a black feminist scholar and poet, on the program as well. We're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862 as we talk about this case today. 877-962-9862. Nia, the fact is the judge didn't want to hear too much about race, said, in effect, racial profiling is not a factor in this case. A lot of people think it was. Tell us about that, your sense of whether or not racial profiling and race had anything to do with this case.
We know that race and racial profiling had something to do with what happened that night with Trayvon Martin. The fact of the matter is, if you go back and listen to the statements that George Zimmerman made, they were not about just anyone. And when he was talking about these people and the things that he was saying, regardless of whatever words he used, people understand in their guts what he was talking about. One of the issues that, or one of the concerns that we have, or one of the things that we need to begin to think about and address, is the honesty about that. If we're going to make any shifts or changes anywhere in this country, we have to actually speak the truth and admit and acknowledge what is going on, what has been going on. This is not new. This is not new. And begin to do the work to change things. We cannot rely on the criminal justice system to be the only thing that actually shifts, or the thing that is directly changing what needs to be going on. One of the things I shared earlier was that I was not necessarily surprised. I did not watch the trial because my expectation was that Zimmerman was going to be found guilty, yet I watched the TV all day waiting for the verdict. I had some sort of hope that there was going to be some sort of validation for black life. As I said, I'm a prison abolitionist, so I don't know what I was hoping would happen. I was not hoping that George Zimmerman would go to jail, but I was looking for some sort of validation for my 18-year-old son's life. And even me, with the work that I do, still had that in my gut, which is different than what I have in my head and understanding of what's going on or what has been going on for centuries.
Mark Anthony Neal, I heard that from a lot of people who claim to be outraged by the verdict but said they really expected that. I think it gets to the logic of a criminal justice system with its narrow parameters that has to operate in a social context. And so talk a little bit about that, the part of the verdict and the trial that just can't get into the case.
You know, I was frustrated by all of the conversation and purposely chose not to comment on it because there was a lot of talk in the court of public opinion that would have no impact, right, on what happens in the courthouse. And as Irv just showed, most Americans have no sense of what the science is in the courtroom. We know what we hear. We know what we feel. We're hearing stuff that the jury doesn't hear. Right. And we don't know the laws and things, structures that they have to follow in making a decision. So it gets frustrating. The dynamic of it that was interesting to me about this case was the kind of social outpouring in support of it. And part of it speaks to the fact that Trayvon Martin in some ways was an ideal victim. Right. Thousands of Trayvon Martins before Trayvon Martin. thousands of Trayvon Martin since Trayvon Martin, right? What makes Trayvon Martin deserving of this kind of attention, not just from black folks, right, but a whole group of multiracial folks? And that's because you have two parents who were there, right, who were engaged parents who, even with their own personal difficulties, are invested in raising these boys. You know, both Trayvon and his brother, you know, solid middle class kids who's making all the right decisions. Those are the kids who aren't supposed to get killed. When Pookie gets killed, right, you know, Pookie might have his hand in the drug game a little bit. He might be involved in this kind of stuff. We write that off as part of the game. Right. So, yeah, he shouldn't have been killed. But, you know, if he was more on the straight and narrow, maybe that doesn't happen. When it's someone like Trayvon, folks are like, it can't happen this way. It's not supposed to happen with a figure like Trayvon. And what's frustrating to me in this regard is that suppose Zimmerman does go to jail, right? Suppose he is found guilty. We still have this work to do. That work doesn't disappear, you know, because we got a W with Trayvon. And I've always been of the mind that the W, the win in this case, was that it even went to trial in the first place, mm-hmm. right? And for those folks who are kind of hanging their heads now about some sort of defeat, the fact that it went to trial was the win, right? The struggle now is that we now have to push back these stand your ground laws, and we also have to deal with stop and frisk. That's the work to be done right now. Right. You know, and we should have our moment. Right.
And the consciousness or the lack of it that
right,
goes around.
Right.
It,
I mean, we should have yeah. our moment. That's important for us to have this kind of moment. But now we need to get back to work.
We will talk about that work and what that work looks like as our conversation continues with Mark Anthony Niello, professor of African and African-American Studies at Duke, Irving Joyner, professor of law at North Carolina Central, Nia Wilson, executive director of Spirit House, Alexis Pauline Gums. We'll hear from her in the second segment and beyond. And you too, 877-962-9862, if you want to join the conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio talking about Trayvon Martin, the image of black men and boys in our legal system. Mark Anthony Niello, a professor of African and African-American Studies at Duke. Irving Joyner is a professor of law at North Carolina Central University and legal counsel for the North Carolina NAACP. Nia Wilson is executive director of Spirit House in Durham. Alexis Pauline Gums, a poet. And we are taking your calls today at 877-962-9862 to talk about this case, the aftermath, and what it means. Alexis, let's hear from you and talk about this case and what it means and the way race plays a part in it.
Absolutely. What I think has such a strong impact on all of us who have been paying attention to this case, who have been thinking about Trayvon Martin, who have been thinking about the black people that we love and that we are, and what the meaning of black life is at this moment, is the fact that the way the law works communicates something to us. It's one of our most shared narratives, right, that we've all been paying attention to, that establishes precedence for whose life matters, when does it matter, and how do we negotiate that. And so I think that thinking about the great Ida B. Wells, who would have been 151 tomorrow, her birthday's July 16th, I think that it is our role to construct those other narratives. The reason that Ida B. Wells created a newspaper, the reason that she organized people to self-publish pamphlets that never would have been part of the mainstream media at the time, and the reason that she had to develop an international anti-lynching movement, was because she did know that you can't just ask a country to be accountable to a set of folks that its structure of laws are actually designed to create inequity in between. So she really had to look to a broader scale and say she was going to use the media to explore and expose what the contradictions were, what the hypocrisies were, what the violence actually was, in particular lynching of black people and sexual violence against black people, especially in the South, but across the United States. And I think about her so much in this moment. What does it mean for us to think about what the disparities are? Right here in North Carolina, we have the repeal of the Racial Justice Act, which showed, right, all the cases that use the Racial Justice Act actually showed and used the statistical disparity in sentencing that is part of the law of our state, and, you know, shows up with the stop and frisk laws in New York City, which shows up with the judge in Florida saying, let's not say that race is a part of this, right? As part of a systemic backlash to say, let's not talk about race, because then we'll have to actually deal with the fact that we are perpetuating a contradiction. We're actually training generations of folks to treat each other differently, to believe different things about themselves and the worth of their lives through the law. So as a fellow prison abolitionist, it's not that I want to see punishment enacted against particular people because of what they do around race or because of how they may express their racism or white supremacy. It's that we have to acknowledge the law is communicating to us all of the time.
Right. And we can see, and there are countless disparities in the ways in which the law is executed and carried out. In those four cases under the Racial Justice Act that made it to the courts, four out of four were commuted. Those sentences were commuted because the judge found that race, in fact, played a part in four out of four cases. And now the law is repealed. And there are other cases. You were talking about them, Irving Joyner, just in the ways, disparities in the way we see laws played out. Black men who go to jail when they stand their ground on their own property. And Mark Anthony Neal, and you can both talk about this, the ways in which African-American men are sentenced over and against what we see in sentencing for whites in this country.
Well, you know, and I think probably a great example of this disparity is in the John McNeil case out of Georgia, where he killed a white man who was on his property attempting to initially assault his son and then was advancing on him. As a result of that death, John McNeil spent close to 5 years in prison before some legal wrangling ended up getting him out. And the facts were pretty similar in a sense to the Zimmerman case, but it shows that there's some despair. And there are other cases, and I just use that right. as one stated example of just that disparity.
I want to go to the phones right now. Dinette is on the line from Durham. It might be Dinette on the line from Durham. Hello.
Hi. You're...
I'm sorry?
You were right the first time.
Dinette. Well, go ahead, Dinette.
Yeah, I'm a black woman and mother of a very young son, and a lot of people are really outraged and aggrieved at the verdict. And one of the things I'm having our time with is a lot of the public response and the criticism that we in the black community don't care as much about black-on-black crime as we do about murders and instances like these or police brutality. Obviously, I see them as both connected, and I know that we in the community certainly do care about all of the violence and the black lives and youth lost. And I'm just interested to hear how you all kind of respond to that narrative or that framing or that criticism that comes out of folks, out in communities.
All right, thank you, Dinette. We'll go around the table here, Nia.
Thank you, Dinette. One of the ways that I've been responding most recently is, as you said, first of all, we do understand the connections. There are many complexities that are not necessarily being taken into account when we begin to just say that black people are not looking at or addressing the issues in their own community. And anyone who wants to have conversations about that is definitely welcome to engage with any one of us, and we can help them to understand that. But secondly, one of the things that we need to point out is, number one, the media doesn't necessarily cover the positive things that are happening in the community or the work that is happening in the community. I feel personally it's disrespectful for people to make those kinds of statements when there are people on the ground every day that are doing work. But it is, again, strategic. There's a reason that it goes unsupported or uncovered within the media so that folks don't necessarily know what's happening. And again, I invite anyone who wants to be involved to be in touch with any one of us or anyone else who's doing work so that we can begin to help and to share with folks the different things that are going on. So it's much more complex than that. And people need to address and understand and address what actually are the reasons for the violence that happened within our own community, and also understand that every group has the same issues, and people don't say that. So when there's violence white on white crime, you don't hear someone say, well, yeah, white people need to be addressing the violence in the white community, or Hispanic or Latino people need to be addressing the violence within their own communities. They only say it in reference to African Americans, to black folks. So people need to really take a look at that.
Well, and I think, you know, I want to hear from the rest of you, but also just in terms of the way we cover violence in general. If a middle-class white young woman who happens to be president of her student body, say Eve Carson, is killed, there's going to be an outpouring of coverage. But every day there are crimes in this city, in parts of the city, that go uncovered. And because, Mark Anthony Neal, you suggest, maybe that individual was involved somehow in criminal activity, that life is seriously devalued by the media that refuses to cover that in the same way, give it the same valence, and weight as another crime. You've just made a statement about which life is more important, and then that statement is conveyed to our listening public in a very subtle but a very real way. Anyway.
Well, you know, historically, society has viewed black life as being cheap. I mean, we go all the way back to the founding of this country, where black life had no value other than economics, and so, you know, so it's just consistent with the view, and society educates itself from its past history, and so those views are continuing today, and we have to continue to try to extricate ourselves from that historical narrative, and it's very difficult to do when you are in a predominantly white society where that view prevails.
And it's the ground you're standing on. I didn't mean to take us off on that tangent, though you can comment on that too, Alexis, but the Danette's question too, this perception out there that African-American commentators only get exercised when it's this kind of a story and ignore black-on-black violence.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it comes down to the fact that we love each other, and sometimes loving each other is illegal to even say how much we love each other, that we value black life. That, by the way, Danette, I love you. I love your son. You're two of the most inspiring people that I know. And I think about that. And so that for me was the first thing that came up when it came to Trayvon Martin, when I started to think about so many of the young people who I know who may or may not be involved in criminal activities. What it means to love someone is not to start taking notches and notching them as death eligible or killable because of who they are or what they do. So I actually have this poem that I wrote for thinking about Trayvon Martin, but also thinking about my own brothers, my cousins, my nephews, and Nia's son and Danette's son as well.
You read it for us?
Yes, it's called Black Goes With Everything. He has wings in his shoes, a rainbow in his mouth, his hooded sweatshirt force field threaded through with angel Kevlar. He has sweet tea time travel in a can. What do black boys beckon with their flight school eyelashes, their hands clutching sugar, their teeth breaking smile? When do raw roads reckon with their Care Bear broken hearts too bright to open, the softness in their shifting waists, cotton waves of sag made shelf life? This is a poem for candy and favors and the warmth of a phone on your face and the slow drag drum of walking alone. This is a song for the night where everything is a shade of black, where truth kisses the ground. This is a poem for sidewalk Morse code, for grass watered with your ocean spray blood. This is the new superhero love tweet, the sacrificial prayer. He has wings in his shoes, a rainbow in his mouth, sweet tea time travel in a can, hooded sweatshirt force field threaded through with angel Kevlar. This is a poem where you have what you need. We need you. Come home.
Alexis Pauline Gums on the state of things today as we look at the aftermath of the George Zimmerman verdict in Florida. This is a question then of perception. It's a beautiful poem. I want to talk to you in a second, Mark, but I know, Nia, you were at a couple of rallies recently and came face to face with this question, particularly when it came to some folks who were at the rally who are white, came from middle class backgrounds and have had kind of awakenings. But I think it sheds light on how difficult it is for people of different backgrounds to really fully understand and grasp the power in that poem and to put themselves in that place and understand it in the way that it was intended and the way that it was written.
Thank you, Alexis. Mm-hmm. The first thing that I want to say about that is that this is about us. The work that I do, I love Black people. I love the Black community. I love my family. I have an 18-year-old son. I am his mother. We work a piece that we actually used at our rally last night called A Prayer for Our Sons, because people need to understand what it means to raise a Black child and be in fear for their lives every day. Melissa Harris Perry shared a piece this morning where she said that she was wishing her sons away. Now, take a moment to think about what that means to have a Black woman say that she wishes her sons away or that they had not been born at this time. That's how deep the fear is. And we appreciate solidarity and allies. It is necessary for all of us to be very active in this system to change things for the better. But we're fighting for our lives here. It's not about a political ideology or a principle. And that's important for people to understand when they engage in what's happening. Sometimes, and to go back to this thing around this not enough people focusing, you know, on the violence in the African-American community, people are tired. People are every day fighting for their lives. Again, you may not see something. You may not see something that you think should be happening in a rally or a speak out or a march. But every day people are raising their children to be able to survive. We say, we teach our sons the mantra, don't run, don't mm-hmm. speak, mm-hmm. don't reach, no mm-hmm. such thing as routine. Mm-hmm. Lower your eyes, lower your voice, life or death, it's not, you have no choice. That's what I've taught my son since he was a baby. And now as he leaves for college in a few weeks, and I'm so proud that we've gotten there. But now I have to worry knowing what's happening in Greensboro because he's going off to UNC. And how the police perceive the A&T students in Greensboro. So that fear doesn't go away just because I got him to this point.
Mark?
When I was growing up in New York City in the 80s, there was a woman, a mother, whose son, I think, was lost to police violence. And she used to create these little pamphlets called the Black Book. And she would hand them out for free. And they were instructions about how Black boys and young Black men should carry themselves when they're confronted with the police. And I'm having these conversations this morning in the car with my 10-year-old daughter. We're talking about composure and how when you're in public and you're upset at something, whether you're in school or in a supermarket or actually confronted by a police officer, because this is stuff that we now have to, conversation we have to have with Black girls now, as well as our boys, that you can't have your moment at that time. You have your moment when you get back home, right? You have to have some sort of composure in these moments because they already read you a certain kind of way, and to lose control just gives them added reason to see you in these kinds of ways. And it's stunning to me, right, that in 2013, right, under the watch of a Black president, right, that this is what we're looking at. You know, talking to someone yesterday, it's like, what does this look like in the future? In the future, given what the Supreme Court just decide what's happening in North Carolina's General Assembly, this isn't 2000. I'm not thinking about 2016. I'm thinking about 1953. Right. Right. And we have to raise our children, right? This whole idea, you know, our kids don't know nothing about reckless eyeballing. Right. That's from another historical moment. But what does reckless eyeballing look like in the digital era? Right. That we have to have those kind of conversations and warning with all of our children now about what this reality is. Right. And, you know, I'm not sure we're even ready or equipped for what that's fully going to look like going forward yet.
Yeah. But the lesson that you're talking about deal with those things where you can see what's happening. Yeah. Trayvon right. Martin wasn't even in a position that he could see. He wasn't in a position where he was outraged and responding. He was profiled because he was just walking home with some Skittles and, I'm reminded, some iced tea. So he was suddenly confronted by a man with a weapon. And now people and it was amazing doing this the prelims to the trial that people then wanted to criminalize Trayvon Martin for what he had done months before and what he could have been thinking about at that moment merely because he was an African American and the fact that he was wearing a hoodie was a tip off that he was up to no good. But I mean, it's just amazing how the stereotype just flows.
I mean, it gets back to what Irv said earlier about the prosecution. You know, even when the defense is pulling out all of these photos of him on social media, where's the social media expert that explains what young folks do with social media that has nothing to do with who they actually are, but their need to project right. something out in the world? I mean, this stuff doesn't – there's a science, right? There's research behind this. The judge's decision not to enter race and not to use the term racial profiling is that there is in literally stacks of research on how black men are profiled, right? The opportunity agenda 2 months before Trayvon's death issued a national report about how the images of black men and boys circulate in the culture and has a direct correlation in terms of policy, in terms of how we deal with black men and boys. None of that gets brought into the court case, right? You know, there's been this running theme in some of the narratives about the case, about the film A Time to Kill. And that whole moment when Sam Jackson says to Matthew McConaughey, you know, your value to me is that you think like them, right? So you have to prosecute this case as if you're thinking like them. The prosecution in this case failed to do that. And one of the things I think is really interesting about the prosecution here, I think they were compromised from the beginning because in order to talk about what was happening in the case, they had to talk about the way that the Sanford police were complicit.
I want to talk more about right. that when our conversation continues on the state of things, 877-962-9862, if you want to join us. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Mark Anthony Neal is with us, a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke. Irving Joyner, a professor of law at North Carolina Central University and a legal counsel for the North Carolina NAACP. Nia Wilson is here, executive director of Spirit House in Durham, and poet Alexis Pauline Gums. We are talking about the George Zimmerman verdict in the Trayvon Martin case. 877-962-9862 is the number to call. When you think about what this means in terms of just trying to understand how early this begins, we take a look at the statistics in Wake County. An African-American young man is three times more likely to be suspended on a first offense for cell phone than a white boy, right? Three times more likely on a first offense for carrying a cell phone. If that happens in high school, then first of all, it does suggest that there's some kind of racial bias in the minds of the people who are enforcing the rule on cell phone use, right? And so then the question is, once you get to the jury, counselor, what's going on in the mind of the juror to discount what came out of the mouth of George Zimmerman at the time of the attack and to weigh more heavily something that a teenager did on social media months and months ago?
Well, I think Mark made the point that the juror is restricted to the instructions from the judge. And the judge is going to instruct the juror that you have to base your opinion just on what is presented from the witness chair. So the testimony that's admissible from the is the only thing that you can think about in reaching this conclusion. I think the judge in Trayvon Martin's case did a good job of maintaining that line in terms of the admissibility of evidence. But it was that line that prevented all of the other relevant information about George Zimmerman's disposition, because had he not chose to racially profile Trayvon Martin and follow him with the gun and obviously confront him, there would have been no death. He just stood his ground and stayed where he was and allowed Trayvon Martin to go home. There would have been no death, but one thing that we can be sure of is that though that series of acts led directly to the killing of Trayvon Martin, and not because of anything that Trayvon Martin did. I would venture to say if I was walking down the street and I turned around and someone was following me with a gun, that I'm going to feel immediately that my life is in danger. And in that situation, whoever wins the fight wins the case.
877-962-9862. Fred's on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Fred.
Hi. Thanks for the call. First of all I wanted out of Martin Zimmerman case was truth and justice. So the real question is, you know, sure, Zimmerman might have been slightly belligerent in asking Trayvon what was going on. And if Trayvon had answered belligerently back, things would have been okay. But, you know, the real question of the trial was he or was he not sitting on Zimmerman beating his head into the ground? That would make the final decision whether to pull your gun out or not. But other than that, my real question is, about 2 weeks ago in Georgia, in Mapleton, outside of Atlanta, four black teenagers beat the pulp out of a white guy, 36-year-old white man, and threw him into traffic where he was run over. About a month ago, there was a woman pushing her 13-month-old baby in a stroller in her neighborhood, in South Carolina, and two teenagers, 17 and 14, came up to rob her. She didn't have any money, so they were pissed off, and they shot the baby in the face. The police figured out who it was by checking school attendance records for that day. My question is, when is the Reverend Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson going to ask the federal government to investigate those crimes as race-based?
All right. Thank you, Fred.
And I think that the answer to that question is to call Al Sharpton. His number is 212-something or other, and then get that information. But, it's really offensive for this person to call us and ask us what Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson are thinking about in this kind of situation when they have enough money and enough gumption to get in contact with them and call them themselves and ask those questions. And why aren't they out there leading some demonstration or some organization that's speaking to these issues?
As if we're a monolith, right? As if we're a monolith.
Right. And, I mean, I think that all of us don't want there to be violence in our communities. All of us value the lives of the other people in our state, in our region, in our country. The question is, when a white teenager walks into a school and shoots everybody in the school, it doesn't become an excuse to enact violence against all white teenagers
right.
because they
right.
may, in fact, wear a trench coat one day and shoot up a school. I think that the point is that the generalization is inappropriate in that case.
I mean, a couple of examples of this. I mean, obviously we're talking about in terms of black folks, and whenever black crime occurs, we want to talk about race and culture. The recent airline that crashed in San Francisco, right? We want to talk about how culture played a role in the lack of communication with the pilots. A young white kid walks into a school and shoots everybody. Let's talk about the number of white women who disappear and their husbands kill them. Mm-hmm. No one wants to talk about race and culture in that context, right? We want to isolate that as random events. And in the case that even this gentleman mentioned, you know, in some ways I don't even want to justify responding to it, but rest assured that those black men will be arrested, will go to trial, and will go to jail.
No doubt about
no
it.
No doubt about
absolutely
that. Right. You know,
no
so what, why are you even having this conversation? But if you are criminals and you're black, you go to jail. Right. What we're dealing with, the fact is, like, there are a bunch of times when you're not criminals and black, you go to jail anyway. Or if you're a black man, you might end up getting killed because someone thinks that you should be going to jail.
Yeah, and there's no evidence that a crime of opportunity is in any way racial profiling.
Right.
If you want money and you rob someone and kill them in the act of doing it, doesn't mean you were following them because they were white.
Which, by the way, poor white people do all the time.
So, but and this gets to questions of racial profiling and even cases here. And I know, Nia, you've been following them in Durham, police brutality and profiling. You know, there's a study at UNC Chapel Hill that was just done very recently on racial profiling. If you're a black man, you're 77% more likely to be stopped by the police than if you're white. And it's and if you're Hispanic, it's you're 98% more likely. So people of color are, for some reason, there is a preference among police officers to stop and frisk. And by the way, the penalties for people who are stopped seem to be more severe as well. So there's something going on, and it seems to me that that's somehow relevant to this discussion, rather than just sort of the sheer volume of crime that's committed, which seems to me on a different plateau.
So there was, thank you, there was a couple of things that I wanted to say about that. First of all, I want to talk just briefly about racial profiling and implicit bias, as some folks are the newest language that's being used. It is a culture that is here in this country. It is not always about whether one person is black or one person is white. And I'll talk about that a little bit when I speak about Carlos Riley. But it is, again, the fact that we're talking about valuing black life. And across the board in this country, we have learned not to value black life. And that is what we need to be talking about and figuring out how to fix and address. In the case of Stephanie Nickerson and Carlos Riley Jr., both cases here in Durham, Stephanie was beaten up by a Durham police officer. There was there were pictures, there was video. People were able to see her face, and they understood by what they saw, although we still had to really organize around because she was charged. Stephanie chose to ask the police officer for a search warrant, and instead of producing a search warrant, he beat her up as though she had no right to exercise her constitutional right. So we did have to organize around it, and Stephanie's charges were dropped. The police department, however, took no responsibility for what happened. What they said was that the police officer, this one police officer, used excessive force. He was not fired. He quit.
He was allowed to resign. Right.
However, what we know is that there's a culture within the Durham Police Department that says that it is okay, again, to go after the lowest hanging fruit, right? If you have created a culture where it's important to arrest people to get your numbers up, you go after the lowest hanging fruit. That is African American and primarily young African American males. So in the case of Carlos Riley, and I'll just take a few minutes to share this, on December 18th, Carlos had dropped his girlfriend off at work. He was on his way home. He stopped to talk to a friend. An unmarked car pulled up behind him. He did not know who it was, and so he pulled off. The siren went off. Carlos pulled over immediately, and there was a confrontation. The officer ultimately assaulted him. And in the struggle, the officer shot himself. And I'll say that every time that I say this, there are many people who are looking for a video. And I got some words for you. We believe Carlos. We actually know the truth. The officer shot himself in the leg. Carlos has been in prison, in jail now for almost, well, since December. His life is forever changed. He is no, the difference between Carlos and Trayvon in this case, he was definitely racially profiled, is that Carlos fought for his life. He was being choked. He was being punched. A gun was drawn. He fought for his life and he survived. He emptied the clip of the gun and he left the scene because he knew that if police officers showed up, he would be dead. So for those who think he should have stayed, who want to say all the different things that he should have done, let's talk about Sean Bell. Let's talk about Oscar Grant. We can name countless people who lost their lives. Now, it has been very difficult to get support for Carlos Riley Jr. in this case because of racial bias, implicit bias, where people want more proof to believe that this young black man actually had to fight for his life.
I have to ask you, though, again, the statistics are overwhelming and they are undeniable that profiling takes place. Race plays an important part in the way police work, the criminal justice system works. How is it that you know that Carlos didn't do the shooting?
It'll come out.
Right.
It's definitely true. And what I'll say beyond that is, again, that Carlos was fighting for his life. There was never an accusation that he pulled the gun, reached for the gun, did anything like that.
It was
the police officer who pulled out the gun. The gun went off. He was shot in the leg. Carlos was being beaten. He was being choked. He had done absolutely nothing wrong. He was headed home.
He was unarmed.
Unarmed.
He was stopped for reasons still unclear.
Right.
And then the officer pulled his weapon.
And Carlos had a job interview the next day. He had 6 days left on his probation. He now is in jail, and he will be right back in this whole system again. 21 years old. His life will, again, is forever changed. Who's going to do something for this young black man?
Take one more call. Omasade is in Durham. Hello, Omasade.
Hey, how are you doing, Frank? Thanks for taking my call.
Doing good.
This actually gets to the question that I had about the entire system being inherently flawed and built on a construct of white supremacy and oppression. And two examples. One was the example I was going to give about Carlos Riley Jr. And the fact that the system has eaten him up in a way where he sees no way out of a situation where he actually survived, but will be incarcerated because he survived. And then the case of Marissa Alexander, who was sentenced to 20 years in prison in Florida on the Stand Your Ground case for aggravated assault for firing a gun into a wall that did not hurt anyone because her ex-husband, who had been physically assaulting her repeatedly, and there's documentation of this domestic violence and abuse in their relationship, and Angela Corey, who's the state attorney general for Florida, prosecuted her to the fullest extent of the law. No one lost their life in that situation. She was protecting herself. She had just given birth to twins 9 days before. There were three children in the house. And so when we talk about this conversation and we talk about black lives and black families and the fear that we are dealing with, we also talk about the system and how inherently flawed this system is, and that there has to be an abolitionist movement to do something about what we encounter every day.
Thanks, Omasade.
Yeah, so to take it back to Ida B. Wells, thanks, Omasade. Thank you for so many things, for everything and who you are in this community. Ida B. Wells also advocated self-defense for black folks, understanding that there was not at the time, at the very beginning of the last century, a situation where black folks could expect to be defended and protected by the law. And clearly that actually is the case right now. She said that she actually recommended black families to be armed. And she felt like that was, in fact, the only resort in a country where life was valued in the ways that it is valued. So I do think that we move in this conversation from who has the right to walk home unharassed and unprofiled to who also has the right to defend themselves. And the logic that we see and that is communicated through George Zimmerman's trial and his acquittal, and of course, as you've mentioned, it's part of a long chain of communication through the law, is that certain people will be punished for defending their own lives. Our lives are worthless enough that to defend them is actually an act against the state. It actually threatens property, right? Like, we're actually that worthless. We make a place less valuable by continuing to exist. That's actually the logic that's being communicated. And I would say it's important, especially for me as a black feminist, to say that I would like our community to remember that the logic that says Trayvon Martin has no right to defend himself from someone who's following him and decides to get out of a car and decides to create a confrontation with him is the same logic that says Cece McDonald, a young transgender woman who is in jail right now, has no right to defend herself when she is attacked. That says that the New Jersey Seven lesbians who defended themselves from somebody who was assaulting them, they have no right to defend themselves, right? And of course, we can take it back to Joanne Little. We can take it back to Rosalie Ingram. We can take it back right to Ida B. Wells.
Right, Sakia Gunn.
So given that there are, like Trayvon Martin, like Sakia Gunn, people who have been killed for not what they have done, but for being who they are, black youth, those youth who have said, in fact, they want to live, and they're going to objectively respond to that situation and defend themselves and try to survive, are punished, which communicates even further that our lives are not worthwhile, are not worth defending from the standpoint of the law, but then when we defend it, we will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Alexis Pauline Gumbs is a feminist scholar and poet. Neil Wilson, Executive Director of Spirit House in Durham. Irving Joyner, a professor of law at North Carolina Central University and counsel for the North Carolina NAACP. Mark Anthony Neal, a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke University. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.